Okay, so tonight I'm just going to do a general introduction. What do we know about John's Gospel already? What is it that's distinctive about it? And then next time we meet, a fortnight's time, I'm going to look at what's called the prologue, the first 18 verses, because like any prologue, it introduces several themes which we're going to see as we go through the Gospel. And I haven't actually got any plans beyond that. So I'm hoping that these 2 weeks will kind of stimulate you, and there are various approaches that we could take. I mean, clearly we haven't got time to do a kind of verse by verse go through it, but there are certain themes that we could pick out, and we'll unravel some of those tonight and next time. So my vision only lasts a fortnight, basically, and after that I'll be flying by the seat of my pants. So nothing new there. So let's begin by reading, if someone wouldn't mind reading, the passage that we're going to look at next week, the prologue, chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. Anyone fancy reading that for us? Great, thank you very much. Now, we will be looking in detail at that passage, as I say, next time, and seeing what kind of themes it introduces. But let's begin with a general brainstorm. What do we already know about John's Gospel, and particularly in comparison to Matthew, Mark and Luke? What are the kind of things that we already know about it? Oh, we don't know anything about it. That's good.
I start by saying
blank canvas. Okay, we will return to that question before the evening's out. Yeah, okay. Anything else we know about it? Well,
Which John?
Yeah, I think the general consensus is that it was written by John the Apostle. No, I don't think
there
is really. But Revelation and the epistles of John appear to come from a different hand. Really? And different from each other. Yes, the beloved disciple. So, yeah.
We're just talking about what we already know about John's Gospel. And we're recording it, but I edit out all you.
Okay.
So you needn't be afraid of saying anything in case it goes on the interweb. Okay, so we've said that it's a different story. We think we know probably who it's by, and that was the beloved disciple, one of Jesus' inner circle. Yeah, anything else?
The I am.
Okay, we'll look at those in a moment, yeah? Yeah. Okay.
Have you said that?
No, we haven't used the word synoptic.
Awesome.
Synoptic comes from optic, obviously seeing, and sun with. So three Gospels tend to see things together, Matthew, Mark, Luke. But John is very different. Now, we're going to see in a moment, actually, there are some quite distinct differences between the three synoptics. But John isn't a synoptic because it is so different. Dennis said, I've not heard that, but 80% of what's in John isn't in any of the other Gospels. And I think that, I think that's probably about right, yeah. Okay, let's have a little look at some of these distinctives. And I want to suggest four P's. See, I can't stop being a preacher, however much I try. First of all, John's Gospel appears to have a very different purpose. Mark is very much the Gospel about what Jesus did. You know that it's an action-packed Gospel. The key word in Mark is a Greek word, euthus, which means immediately. And you get that again and again. Jesus hardly stops. Immediately he goes to the synagogue. Immediately he does something else. So Mark is kind of Gospel in a hurry, but doesn't really have much teaching. You don't get Sermon on the Mount, for example, in Mark. So Mark is interested in what Jesus did. Matthew and Mark are far more interested in what Jesus said, and in particular Matthew, what Jesus said to the Jews. So you've got things in Matthew like lots of this happened to fulfill the Old Testament scriptures. Matthew doesn't use the term kingdom of God, because a good Jew is not allowed to say God, so Matthew always uses kingdom of heaven. Luke, on the other hand, still interested in what Jesus says, but far more to the Gentiles. So he's happy to use terminology like the kingdom of God. But in both of those, you get serious wodges of teaching. Matthew clumps it all together into different sections, the Sermon on the Mount, three chapters there, and then teaching later on, and so on. Luke tends to spread it out a bit more through the gospel, but there's a tremendous amount about the teaching. John seems to be far more interested in who Jesus is. You do get teaching, you do get action, obviously, but we'll see in a moment that the big question there is, who is this Jesus? So that's one distinctive, a different purpose. Secondly, John's gospel comes from a very different period. What do we know about that? Any ideas? No? Okay. I don't know how many of us were here when we first looked at the Gospels, but we talked about a source called Q, which is from the German word meaning source, and we don't have it. It doesn't exist. Nobody's found it. But it's thought to be the material that Matthew and Luke have together that nobody else has. And it's basically a teaching source. So you get a lot of stuff, as I say, Matthew and Luke, with Jesus teaching. And that's thought to come from a source which we no longer have called Q. But Q is generally dated around the 40s. So you're talking, 7 years after the death of Jesus, all his teaching began to circulate, and maybe it was written down as the very first attempt to capture some of that teaching. St. Paul was writing in the 50s, so the epistles come before the Gospels, generally speaking, even though they come after them in our Bibles. Mark, the earliest of the Gospel, probably from the 70s, and this is not an exact science, but it's the best guess of scholars. So Mark is the first Gospel, and the thought is that Mark gets his stuff from Peter directly. Then Matthew and Luke, probably written in the 80s, using some of the Q stuff from 40 years earlier. John, it's generally reckoned, was about 95. So John is an old man. He's got all these other accounts to reflect on. And he probably doesn't think there's any point in simply telling the story again. Rather, he's reflecting on it more deeply. So if I asked you the question, those of you who were there, what happened in church on Sunday morning? Anyone tell me what happened? There was a baby. Johnny preached really well, brilliantly. Okay. So what you're telling me is specific details, a baby, a sermon, a lady who brought her friends to Alpha. Okay. Now, if I was to ask you, tell me about your first ever service at St. Swithin's, what can you remember about that? What would you tell me? Okay, so you can remember one specific thing. With length of time, our memories get less specific and more general. So welcoming was the very first thing you said, the first thing that you can remember. And that's what you get when you reflect on something with a lot of hindsight. So Matthew and Luke, particularly if they're using that Q source, are talking details. You know, this happened very recently. John is much more big picture. Who was this Jesus? What's not what happened? There was a baby. Why was there a baby? What does that say about us as a church that we get babies up the front? You know, that kind of thing. So that's just a simple illustration of the kind of nature of the account of Jesus that you get given that extra space of time. And if you compare John with the very first attempts to capture Jesus' teaching, you're talking 55 years difference. We don't even know if it exists.
It doesn't exist.
But, well, no, I mean, it doesn't exist, but...
If it did exist.
If it is a hypothetical answer to the question, why is there so much that Matthew and Luke have that the others don't? And one solution is that either Matthew copied Luke or Luke copied Matthew. But that's generally not thought to be the case. I mean, not everyone agrees with this, but the leading hypothesis really is that there is this lost source. And all we know about it is the material that we can share. So if I was to say to Sarah, tell us about this baby, and if I was to say to Chris, tell us about this baby, if you both came out with exactly the same words, I would suspect that there had been some kind of collusion. It's not just that they're telling the same story, it is, as Jess says, really, really clear verbal agreement. Okay? So, different purpose for John's Gospel comes from a different period, a different person. We've already mentioned this. If it is John, the beloved disciple, what do we know about him particularly as against other disciples? Yes, okay. Yeah, at the cross in John's Gospel. What else do we know about John as disciple? Yeah, exactly.
James and John?
Peter, James and John were the kind of his besties within the 12. And they were party to some things that the other disciples weren't, like
transfiguration
is the key one, Gethsemane, healing of Jairus' daughter. Took Peter, James and John with him. So John didn't just have the kind of knowledge of Jesus that the others did, he was absolutely there in the inner circle. We get that picture of him reclining with Jesus, and when they reclined at table, they would have laid around the table with their heads towards it and their feet kind of sticking out. So you could quite literally be bosom buddies, because you would be kind of leaning on each other like that. And there's one bit where John kind of whispers to Jesus, you know, who is it? So you get this inner thing, which again, you know people better. So, you know, we think we know Jim, but probably Matt would know him at a much greater depth as a person, which ties in with what we've said about the purpose. And fourthly, a different place. And I've rather given the game away there by forgetting to animate this slide. Does anyone know where John was living when he wrote his gospel?
Ephesus,
indeed. Well done. How did we know that? The other gospels are basically centred around Jerusalem, Palestine. By the time John is writing, at some ripe old age, he's living in Ephesus, and we know that from extra-biblical traditions. But actually, I think that in itself shapes the gospel, because any piece of writing is written to a particular context. So it's worth just taking a little detour to ask about Christianity in Ephesus around this time. And there are some quite, I think, interesting and revealing things that come out of that. And we know, for example, that there were two errors or kind of heresies that they were fighting within the church in Ephesus. Can anyone remember or look up what was going on in Acts chapter 19? Because I think we have a clue there. In fact, would you like to read us Just the first five verses will do. Okay, now that's a very interesting passage, and this may be a bit of a circular argument, but what you've got going on in Ephesus at that stage, which of course is a long time before John was writing, is people who thought that John the Baptist's baptism was the real thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And Paul needs to come along and say, actually, that was a good first step, but John pointed towards the one who was to come after. Now, when you read John's Gospel, there is, we'll talk about this next time, but there is a lot in John's Gospel about John the Baptist. We heard some of it in the prologue that Reuben read earlier. And the theory goes that in Ephesus there was too much emphasis on John the Baptist, and that was something that had continued. Now, we don't have a whole lot of evidence for that other than this particular passage, but it may be that what John chooses to write in his gospel about John in the context of Ephesus suggests that there is an ongoing problem here. As I say, that may be a circular argument, but it's interesting. We'll see that when we see exactly what Jesus does say about John the Baptist in John. And secondly, in Ephesus, and we do know this, there was too little Jesus. Ephesus, we'd now say it's in Turkey. In those days it would have been Asia Minor. So very, very influenced by Greek philosophy. Obviously a Gentile place, not a Jewish place. And it would have been very influenced by Greek philosophy. Now, if you want a noddy guide to Greek philosophy, and this is really crass because obviously it's a very wide subject, but generally speaking, since the time of Plato, who was much earlier than this, the basic deal was that there is the real world, which is the spiritual world up there where the gods live and everything. And then there is our physical material world, which is an imperfect copy of what the real world up there is like. So there is a great separation between the spiritual and the physical. And that has continued to influence the church down the ages, this gap between the spiritual things and the physical things, such that a very lively evangelical church, which we worked in a few years ago, I wasn't a vicar, I hasten to add, deliberately had the PCC to look after things like the gutters and the church boiler, and the elders who would look after the kind of spiritual life of the church, you know. And what they'd done is made that division straight out of Greek philosophy. They didn't seem to see that the boilers could be a spiritual matter. And so there is always this kind of separation in Greek philosophy. And we know, in particular, that there was a philosopher called Corinthus, who was a contemporary of St. John. So again, he's writing at the end of the first century. And he was what's called a docetist. In other words, Jesus only seemed to become human. The Greek word that docetism comes from is the word to seem, to appear. And so Jesus actually belonged to the spirit world. And when he came down, he wasn't a real person. He wasn't a real human. He was kind of like an angel or ghost. He kind of appeared to people and did that, but he wasn't a real human. We know that Corinthus was one of St. John's fiercest opponents. There's a lovely story where St John went for his early morning dip at the local swimming pool and found that Corinthus was already in the water, and he immediately leapt out of the water and he said, I can't be polluted by being in the same water as this heretic. So there was a real fierce rivalry, and one theory is that people said to John, look, can you write an account of the Jesus you knew as he really was, in order to counter this guy Corinthus? Now, that is important because, and we've already mentioned this, we're going to see that in John's Gospel, more than in any other, we have a Jesus who is fully human. Yeah? Examples of that from John's Gospel. What does Jesus do humanly in John's Gospel? John 11, his friend dies. He bursts into tears. Mm. Goes to the wedding. He slept. Chapter 4. Yes. And what else? He was thirsty. He was also, when he sat down at the well, John tells us that he was tired. Knackered and thirsty. So John goes to great lengths to show us a real human Jesus. It's not that the other Gospels don't, but John really seems to lay that on thick, and that's one of the things we'll see as we go through it. But also, Jesus is fully divine. And where are you getting that in John? Right from the very first verse. But after the cross, almost the very end of the Gospel, who have you got? Who's one of the last people? Who says, my Lord and my God.
Yes.
So it's like in two big brackets around John's Gospel that Jesus is divine, as well as the fact that he's human. And again, we're going to see those two emphases. Can we come to that in a moment?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So anyway, that's our four P's. Different purpose for the Gospel. Different period, much longer reflection, chance for reflection. Different person, one of Jesus' very closest friends. And in particular, we suspect, written in this particular place and the context of some of the issues that were going on there. Okay, let's talk then in a little bit more detail in terms of introduction. And let's look first at what John leaves out of his Gospel. Now again, I've got a list here and you won't think of them in the same order, but let's just brainstorm some of the things. Well, you ought to be able to animate PowerPoint in the order you like when people come up. Okay, let's stop with that moment, because you are doing this in the right order at the moment, so that's good. If you want to tell a story, where do you start?
Once upon a time.
So, again, if you wanted to tell the story of St. Swithin's, some of you might start on Remembrance Sunday 20, whatever it was.
No, when, or the concept or the initial challenge.
You might go back further. Chris and I can remember St. Swithin's before Jim arrived. Mm. That's a different story. Other people would be able to remember St. Swithin's 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. So where do you actually start telling your story? And the four Gospels all start in different places. So Mark, where does he begin? Yeah. So Jesus in Mark, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, and it's about his baptism and his ministry. So Jesus never gets born in Mark. He never grows up. And that ties in because Mark, as we said, is interested in what Jesus did. So for his purposes, before he was baptized and started healing and stuff, he hadn't actually done anything worth writing about. Okay, so Mark begins with Jesus' ministry. What about Matthew? He goes a little bit further back. Yeah, so where does he begin if he's wanting to write for a Jewish audience? Okay, you've got that, what in the old Bible used to be begat, so everyone begat. Exactly.
The Jews.
Absolutely, yes. For the Jews, Abraham is the geezer. That he's where it all started. Nothing really worth talking about happened before Abraham, right?
Also through David.
And that reflects, and it comes through David's line as well, greatest king Israel ever had. What about Luke, though, writing for a Gentile audience? Where does he go back to? Yeah, if you look at Luke's genealogy, he goes a lot further back to Adam, because Matthew wants to say Jesus is the Messiah for the Jews. Luke wants to say Jesus is the king of the whole human race. Yeah, so in Luke 3, he goes right back to Adam, the son of God. Yeah? So where does John start? The beginning. And it's interesting, or at least I think it's interesting. John chapter 1, in the beginning, is a deliberate echo of the Greek phrase, which, if you translated the Old Testament into Greek, the Hebrew Bereshith in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created. The version that they would have used, translated into Greek, would begin with exactly the same words as John's Gospel. So John is taking us back, not just to the start of Jesus' ministry, not just to Abraham, not even just back to Adam, but before everything, the beginning of everything. Exactly. And that is one of those, you know, when people ask the question, who made God? It's just a mind-boggling concept. It's like space. Apparently space, we now believe, I think, is spherical. And it stops. It has boundaries and it expands. And immediately that begs the question, well, what is beyond that? And the answer is nothing. Now, we can't get our heads around that. But I think that's exactly where John wants to take us to.
Yeah.
And actually, Jesus is the agent of creation. Jesus is the one who... we saw this in Job, didn't we? But Jesus is the one with whom and through whom God creates. Nothing has been made that hasn't been made through Jesus. So he really is wanting to take us back. Now, in answer to the question, why are there no birth narratives? I guess there's two possibilities. What do you think? Why, in the light of that, why doesn't John tell us about shepherds and wise men? And okay, that's one possibility. Well, we know that. They've covered that. Luke's done the shepherds. Okay. Yeah, so he doesn't want to put too much emphasis on the human Jesus at that point. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yes, because Corinthus would say that Jesus appeared to become human at a particular point in history. John would say he's always been around. Okay, yeah, that's another reason that he wouldn't have been an eyewitness to, so he wasn't bothered. He was more interested in what he knew and what he saw firsthand than in what others had told him. Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is we just don't know. But all those are kind of possibilities and contenders, aren't they?
Can I just throw something in here then?
Okay, to what extent was the Spirit influencing or inspiring, if you like? I've got a nice thick book upstairs which explores that very question. What do we mean by Scripture being inspired?
Yes.
And it's not a simple question to answer. I mean, at one extreme, you've got what's called divine dictation, where you sit there with your pen and the Spirit kind of almost moves your hand and tells you what's right. Mm. At the other end, you've got a human being writing with their particular gifts and creativity and slant and all that.
Yeah.
But somehow we believe by faith that the Spirit is behind that. Mm-hmm. Another view is that Scripture isn't inspired. What the work of the Spirit is what he speaks into us as we read and listen to Scripture. Which is why you can get so many different things in a congregation out the same passage, because the Spirit will be... So it's a very complex thing. And I think the lowest common denominator answer to that question is that we believe that what is written in the Scriptures, the Spirit says, and to try and dig too deeply into exactly how that came about... Is beyond mere mortals like us. But I mean, it's a really good question, a very important one. We would believe that the Spirit was involved, helping, the Spirit bringing to mind.
Yes.
Other people say that the Spirit was at work in the people in later centuries who decided what would go in the Scriptures and what wouldn't. Because there are any number of Gospels that we've still got that never made it into Scripture. And when you read them, you can see why. But, you know, there was a point at which the church said, OK, this is in and that isn't. So you've got to see the work of the Spirit in that as well. So, I mean, really fascinating subject to get into. Okay, so John leaves out birth narratives, and we come up with half a dozen reasons why he might have done that, and we don't know at the end of the day, but he doesn't. Anything else that John leaves out that you can think of? You're going to be a bit surprised by some of these, I was. You've got no baptism of Jesus, but neither have you got... Yeah, you haven't got the temptation narratives. Just stick with baptism... For the moment, what else do you get in the synoptics about baptism? You get Jesus' baptism, but you also get, we get a lot of John the Baptist, as we'll see next time. What does Jesus, in Matthew, what does Jesus tell the church to do? Yeah, to go and baptize. It is, you get Jesus being baptized at the start. You get the command to the church to go and make disciples and baptize them at the end. Neither of those are present in John. Mm-hmm. You do get baptism talked about, but Jesus doesn't actually get baptized. Okay. And while we're talking about baptism, what else don't you get in John's gospel? What goes alongside baptism in the church? You get no Eucharist, no communion in John's Gospel at all. You get the Last Supper, but that's got a completely different emphasis. There's no command to do this in remembrance of me. There's no account of what the church has turned into Eucharistic prayers. You get it in 1 Corinthians 11. You get it in the three synoptics. You do not get Eucharist at all. In John's Gospel. We'll explore that a little bit further. Okay, so no birth narratives, nothing about sacraments, anything else you don't get. Sort of, how does Jesus teach in the synoptics largely?
Parables,
yeah. You get no parables in John, no parables. What you tend to get in the synoptics, although they're lumped together into long sermons, you get individual what's called pericope paragraphs. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who did this, you know, just a few verses. The kingdom of heaven is like such and such. Jesus teaches in parables. In John, he teaches in sermons. You get much longer sections that are not broken up and are not generally stories.
Okay.
Along with that, what else don't you get in John? And you're going to argue with me over this one, and I'm going to convince you. You don't get Jesus telling parables. You don't get Jesus doing
miracles.
Miracles.
Oh.
There are no.
I did not know that.
There are no miracles in John's Gospel.
I don't agree with you.
No. Yeah.
Just came to me.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes.
Didn't know. He hasn't run.
You get supernatural things happening, but no, they're never described as miracles. They are always signs, and there are seven of them in John's Gospel. And one possible thing that we might want to go on and look at after next week when we do the prologue is a little mini-series on the seven signs of John's Gospel, or six, because we've already done one of them twice. But there are no miracles in John, not described as miracles. And one more thing, I didn't know this until I prepared this. Another major feature of the synoptics that you don't get anywhere in John's Gospel, any guesses? What's Jesus do? He teaches in parables, he works miracles. What else does he do in the synoptics? Quite a lot of.
That's it.
There is nothing. No demons at all in John's Gospel. No deliverance ministry, casting out demons or anything like that. All those things are missing from John. And yeah, that's something that we'll definitely look at sooner or later. The simple answer is a miracle is something that happens. A sign is something that points to something. And John selects seven supernatural things that Jesus did, and he tells us from among many, you know, the whole world couldn't contain the books that were written if he wrote down everything, but he picks out just seven because he wants to point us in a particular direction. Okay, so why now? Let me just come back to the sacraments. It may be that John does actually do sacraments but does them in a different way. So it may be that the closest we get to the Eucharist is Jesus saying, I am the bread of life. And it's the same kind of theme, but it's not done in the same way. Yeah, does that make sense? What about baptism? Can you think of something in John that might obliquely refer to baptism like that? It doesn't say that specifically. I think it's John 7. It's not the cross. It's the Feast of Tabernacles, when they would have poured gallons and gallons of water out from the temple and it all would have flowed down. And Jesus says, is anyone thirsty? Come to me and drink. And out of you will flow. So Jesus does bread. He does water. Which may be oblique references to baptism and the Eucharist, but nowhere like in the synoptics does he say, do this. Okay? Another thing which you don't appear to get in John is Gethsemane, but there is actually one verse where Jesus says, I think it's chapter 12. Let me find the actual verse. I think it's one verse that could be John's version of Gethsemane. Yes, 12:27. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. So that might be John's Gethsemane. Okay, so he kind of perhaps does these things, but he treats them very differently. Okay, finally, let's have a look at what John puts in. What do we see in John that we don't see in the synoptics? We've already talked about some of these. We see these long, what we call discourses. So you've got chapters 14 to 16 are, I think, actually quite a rambling and boring section, those three chapters. And they're called the farewell discourses because they're meant to be Jesus' last words before he goes to the cross. And I think they don't do a lot for me, really. I'd rather have some little parables personally. But you do get these long things. And you get the thing, if you look in chapter 3, and you get this quite often, it begins with an incident or a conversation. So Jesus is talking to Nicodemus. And then in verse 9, Nicodemus says, how can this be? And then he's off. And he goes on them for ages. And it's like Nicodemus has vanished from the scene. And it's just an opportunity for a sermon. And you get that quite a lot. You know, that some Greeks later on say, can we come and see Jesus? And he's off on another great big thing. So I think, personally, they're the least enjoyable bits of John's Gospel. Quite boring, but... There's not some good stuff. There's not some good stuff in there, but actually to read them, my heart sinks a little bit when it comes to that. Okay, so you've got long discourses. Another thing you see in John, who is Jesus with largely in the synoptics? Yeah, and when he's preaching or teaching or that. Yeah, it's the multitudes, the crowds, isn't it? Don't really get that in John. It's much more individuals. So he's got Philip and Nathaniel in chapter 1. He's got his mum in chapter 2 at the wedding. He's got Nicodemus in chapter 3. He's got the fattest lady in the Bible in chapter 4, the woman of Samaria, and so on. So and it's not that he doesn't encounter individuals in the synoptics, but you don't really see him big time with the crowds following him around John. There's an 80-20 rule here, but it's about emphasis. And it's like the real Jesus of the synoptics is happy when he's standing in front of a huge crowd. John's real Jesus is a one-to-one kind of guy. Yeah, you've got a different journey. In the synoptics, it's basically a journey to Jerusalem, whereas in John's Gospel, probably more realistic, he's going backwards and forwards and going to the Passover and going to Tabernacles and so on. So the journey is different. Yeah, we've talked about seven signs instead of the synoptic miracles. Another key characteristic, we've already mentioned this and we said this might be something we could look at in more depth, I am sayings. Mm. I am the light of the world, I am the bread of life, I am the true vine, all those kind of things. Don't get any of those in synoptics at all, and they're quite rich. And again, that would tie in with John's emphasis on who is this guy exactly. Trying to explain that. We mentioned the foot washing. The Last Supper in the synoptics is all about the Eucharist and Jesus instituting it and saying, you've got to carry on doing this. Yes, that's the other difference. Now, this is quite technical, Jess, help me out here. It's whether it happened on Thursday or Friday, isn't it? And John moves it. John wants to show Jesus as the Passover lamb who is going to save his people from them. So he potentially moves it, although, you know, as Jess said, we can argue little bit about that. But the Last Supper anyway is all about Jesus' foot washing, which again leads into a discourse about servanthood and so on. No Eucharist there. What do you get in John after the resurrection? Again, something that none of the others mention. Now, there's a particular incident that John tells us. Cooking breakfast. You've got Thomas.
I don't think he's in any of the other Gospels, is he?
Not in that story, no. But there's another important thing. Peter. That's the business. Yeah. We may have talked about this before, but there's a Greek word called anthrakia, which is where we get anthracite from. And it means a charcoal fire. And it occurs twice only in John's Gospel. When can you think of charcoal fires in John's Gospel? One's on the beach. When's the other one before that? Peter denies Jesus three times by an Anthracia. After the resurrection, Jesus builds an Anthracia and says to Peter three times, do you love me? You don't get...
It's a tingle down the spine moment, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful? Just... Only two occurrences of that word. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Love it. You get the denial, but you don't get the reinstate, and you don't get Jesus, as it were, creating the scene for this to happen. So... Finally, and we'll stop with this for tonight and begin to explore it a bit more. What you do get in John is quite a few key motifs which keep coming and coming and are obviously John trying to tell us something. Now, we've mentioned one already. I think it was Reuben said about seeing. Yeah, was that you? Maybe it wasn't you. Someone said about seeing in John's Gospel. And we will discover that that's like a golden thread that runs through. And along with seeing goes believing. Yeah, you get a big tie-up between those themes. Yeah. Anything else that... From what you know about John, are some of the key things that's there are quite a few of them. We'll begin to uncover some of these because a lot of them are set out in that prologue. John's quite deliberately introducing us to some of the themes. That another one is life. Get that a lot in John. Those kind of themes.
Resurrection and life.
Yeah, all sorts of. Well, I simply wanted tonight to kind of whet your appetite a little bit for some of the stuff that is in here and isn't in here. And as I say, next time, we'll look in a little bit more detail at the prologue. That, in the light of what we've discovered tonight, how is John introducing his gospel? And then we'll go on from there and try and work out how we want to tackle it as a group. All right?